Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Ambassador Gregory L. Schulte, who is a senior visiting fellow at the National Defense University Center for the Study of Weapons of Mass Destruction. Ambassador Schulte, welcome to Berkeley, or welcome back to Berkeley.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Southern California. Please don't hold that against me being here in Northern California. And I was born to two parents who wanted their kids to do well who didn't quite understand why their son went into government. But I guess eventually when I became ambassador, they thought it was okay.
And where did you do your undergraduate work?
I did my undergraduate work here at UC Berkeley and studied political science and also a little bit of economics, too.
And any particular profs here who influenced you?
Well, I have a couple. There's one who's no longer here. His name is Kenneth Waltz. And I still quote him today because he had written a controversial article at the time making the case that the more countries that had nuclear weapons, the safer the world would be. And as I went out to try to examine this theory as a practitioner, I actually became quite happy that Professor Waltz was a professor and not a statesman, because it's a theory I didn't want to test out. I also had another professor who's still professor emeritus here, Andrew Mianos, who looked at comparative political systems, and he had gotten out from Hungary during their quashed revolution. I know that had a major impact on me in thinking about not just communism, but also thinking about different political systems and how they influence the way those countries behave in the international system and treat their own populations.
But at Berkeley, you didn't get the academic bug, so to speak, to pursue a career in political science. You went into government. How did that choice come about? Was Princeton a stepping stone to that, and that what pushed you in that direction?
Well, I was associated with the Undergraduate Political Science Association here, and at one point we decided to put on a career day, and it occurred to me, I wonder what all the other political science students are doing. And I talked to all my colleagues. They were all going to law school. A small number wanted to get a PhD and teach, and I wasn't interested in either. I was interested in public service. And so it was clear to me I had to go from sort of the theoretical analysis of political science to more applied. And so I applied to a number of schools and ended up at Princeton at the Woodrow Wilson School looking at public policy. But this was provided a very good foundation for moving on to prepare for public policy.
And was there a particular focus at Princeton in your work there, or it was just a kind of a general education, general graduate education?
Well, it was a general education, but my focus was on international relations. I knew I wanted to join either the Foreign Service or the Department of Defense, which is where I ultimately ended up.
Mm-hmm. And what was your final decision? Because we want to clarify, actually, this year you're an academic, but you're still a government official. So
that's correct.
Are you in the Foreign Service or are you in the government service?
I'm a hybrid. It's funny, a lot of my colleagues think, well, is he Foreign Service? Is he DOD? Is he political? And I'm a little bit of everything, so I call myself just sort of a public servant. I had the choice when I graduated from Princeton of either going into the Foreign Service, I'd passed the exam, or going into the Office of the Secretary of Defense, who's something nowadays called the Presidential Management Fellowship Program, both great ways into government. And my wife, who's more adventurous than I was, really wanted me to pick the Foreign Service because she was ready to go to Chad. I didn't want to go to Chad, and so I took the more safe way in a way and joined the Office of Secretary of Defense, where I was able to work on the intersection of European politics, defense policy, and arms control in the form of the INF Treaty at the time. Now, I had the opportunity to become an ambassador later on when I was in Vienna, and there I worked with a lot of Foreign Service colleagues, and I realized, boy, maybe I passed up a great career because they had all sorts of adventures throughout their career that I missed out on.
So let's pull some lessons out from you. And one thing that I would be curious about is what are the skills required to do what you do, which is be a public servant in the international relations defense field?
Well, I think one of the skills, I mean, you have a, you know, a lot of different career tracks that you can pick. Sometimes you need a very technical skill. Sometimes you need more of a general skill. Where I've served, being a generalist is important. And being a generalist means a couple of things. It means knowing your limitations, knowing you need to find technical experts who can inform you on technical issues, knowing enough of the technical issues so you can ask hard questions and build upon what they tell you. It also means the ability to reach out to different viewpoints, to understand that there are different viewpoints that are out there and that each has their own legitimacy or each has their own worldview, and to be able to figure out how do you operate in this cloud of views and how do you forge consensus. And I think the last thing that's important is an ability to think strategically. Okay, what are we trying to achieve as a nation? What is this president trying to achieve? What is this Secretary of State trying to achieve? And then to translate those strategic objectives into concrete action that has impact. There are a lot of people who are good about thinking about big strategic thoughts but don't know how to implement them. There are a lot of people who are good at doing their day-to-day jobs, but they forget about the strategic picture. Part of the challenge is to bring those two together.
There's a lot more continuity than there is discontinuity. I mean, our leaders get elected on the notion of naysaying what has gone before, and oftentimes they come in and reverse their position when they when the tire hits the road, when they are exposed to the thought processes of the government and the interests also that are there.
Well, when they face not just the government, not just the permanent government, yeah, people like me, but also the reality of the world. Mm-hmm. An administration will come in with a very definite agenda. I think I was the only senior official on Sandy Berger's National Security Council staff under the Clinton administration who Condi Rice asked to stay on under President Bush. And so I saw and was involved in a lot of the transition. And the new administration came in with a couple of issues they really wanted to work. And then what happened? Part of the world I was dealing with, Macedonia, we had a little incipient insurgency, which took a lot of time. The Chinese forced down a P-3 naval aircraft, which took a lot of time. The world sort of grabbed the new administration, set the priorities for it. You then think about this administration on Iran. I was just at a talk that General Jones, the National Security Advisor, gave, and he talked about Iran. And I thought afterwards, he's making the same arguments that I was making 2 years ago about where we were in our strategy. And I'm not faulting the current administration, or the last one. Dealing with Iran is a tough problem. But, you know, there aren't that many variants to the strategy that you can adopt.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is frustrating for the electorate because oftentimes, and I think I can think of President Clinton as a candidate, took a very hard line toward China and human rights there. Candidate Bush took a very hard line on the notion that, well, we shouldn't be doing nation building. And in both instances, what you just described came about. How do you see this dilemma for democracies? In other words, you're telling us that they are grabbed by the realities of the world and the realities of the policy process, and they sort of turn in their positions. Is that a negative for our notions of, well, we elected this guy not to do nation building, we elected this other guy to crack down on Chinese human rights violations?
Well, first off, I have to say, as somebody who's been in government for almost 30 years, it is good periodically to have a new set of eyes come in. I mean, you don't want the government run by a bunch of permanent bureaucrats like myself. I mean, you want a foreign policy that reflects the political direction of the leadership, that reflects the interests not just of the country as we define them, but as the democratic system does. Now, that said, I think what we've seen, over the last 50 years is we've seen bipartisanship fade away from the conduct of foreign policy. And so it does mean that every 4 to 8 years, there's sort of a new shift in emphasis, even if in the end you drive back to the middle. Part of my job, I learned, it wasn't in my job description, but I still had to do it, whether I was, at NATO or in Vienna, was to try to explain this to our friends and allies. Now, there are a lot of countries, the Brits, the French, and Europeans, who are fairly sophisticated observers of our political scene, and they understand the implications of domestic politics for our foreign policy. But there are others who didn't quite understand, you know, is the U.S. going to abandon our commitments here? What is the U.S. doing there? And part of my job was to sort of unofficially reassure them that, you know, we do have some lasting interests. It does take a time to stand up a new administration. You know, give the new administration a little breathing space so it can get on the ground, and it'll come and it'll address your concerns, and we'll make sure that they understand those concerns.
You, in your career, were in positions to be close to the government's reaction to a number of shocks, especially the end of the Cold War with the fall of the wall in 89 and the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then the terrorist attack in 2001. And both of those sort of posed new agendas and required transforming some of the organizations that were intimately involved. Let's talk now about those. The Cold War ends. The Soviet Union is gone, and we have this alliance that whose main purpose was to defend Europe from an attack from the Soviet Union. There was a debate. People like Mark Danner, I think George Kennan, you know, questioned the utility of NATO after that. You were involved with NATO. Tell us your position and then how, as a government official, you rethought the role of NATO.
Well, here we had this wonderful, it has its problems, but basically a wonderful, successful alliance that had effectively won the Cold War. And it was this good instrument whereby the U.S. could work with its closest allies in terms of political consultations, in terms of military planning exercises, and the employment of military force. Did it make sense to throw that away at the end of the Cold War? And actually, the greatest advocate for keeping NATO around was my first boss in Brussels, Manfred Werner, who was the German Secretary General. And he wanted NATO to do three things. He wanted NATO to go out of area. You may remember he talked about out of area or out of business. He understood that if NATO did nothing, it would fade away. He wanted NATO to enlarge to the east to provide stability, even though that would make the Russians nervous. And he wanted NATO to stop the fighting in the Balkans, because it was clear that the Europeans on their own couldn't do that, and you needed NATO and you needed U.S. engagement. In the end, Manfred Werner died before all those things happened, but they all happened. And I think, again, it shows the importance of leadership of Manfred Werner and others who thought like him to take this alliance and move it to deal with the new realities. Now, in my career, it was neat being an ambassador. It was fun working at the White House. But probably the most rewarding part of my career was being at NATO. I was sent there on the international staff to be the director of nuclear planning at the end of the Cold War. We were shipping most of our nuclear weapons out. We rewrote our strategy and planning and consultations. And then I was worried I wasn't going to have much to do. So I went to my boss, Michael Legg, a Brit, said, Michael, give me something else to do. You know, typical type A American. And Michael said, well, you know, we're just getting involved in Bosnia. Would you like to do that? And I said, well, sure, why not? There's a lesson there for career development. It's volunteer and go outside your zone of comfort occasionally. And it was the best thing that happened to me at that point. We put together a little Bosnia task force. It was multinational, brought in people from all sorts of disciplines, military and civilian. And we looked at how do we take this Cold War alliance and how do we develop a consensus amongst countries? How do we work with the military authorities to shift it from, you know, defending against the Warsaw Pact to being involved in the diplomacy and to ultimately putting forces into Bosnia to help implement the Dayton Peace Agreement? And this wasn't easy. I mean, you had, you know, a philosophical debate, largely the French versus the rest of the alliance about, you know, should NATO act independently or should it be wholly subordinate to the UN Security Council? You had countries like Germany at the time who were very nervous about going out of area. How could they do that? How could they commit their forces to that? In the case of the Balkans, you had, you know, different diagnoses of what was going on there. A lot of Europeans saw it as a civil war you know, something dangerous to get involved in. In the U.S., we tended to see it more of a war of aggression, Milosevic against the Muslims. And so swinging the alliance, and we had the Russians who wanted us to go away. We had the U.N. and OSCE with whom we'd never worked before, and so we had to establish relations to work that. But we were able to work our way through it. And I think the reason we were able to do it is we had an existing structure with good people who were populating it, and we had American leadership. You know, America stood in and said, okay, we are ready. This is the Clinton administration. We're ready to be involved in stopping the war in the Balkans, and we're ready to use NATO as an instrument. And what unified the alliance, only 16 countries at the time compared to 28 today, but what unified the alliance was a sense that we had to stop this war that was taking right on the outskirts of Europe, and NATO remained an important instrument, and we had to help uphold its credibility.
Now, the conflict there involved NATO having a war strategy and winning the war, first order, but then to pivot, once the war was over, into what we might call a nation-building, institution-building, peacekeeping agenda. Were the obstacles comparable in both situations, or is it easier to fight a war in unity than it is to rebuild after the war in unity?
Well, we had, in a way, two wars. We didn't call them wars in NATO. That was much too military. But effectively, there were two wars. There was the war with Serbia in Bosnia, and then to implement the Dayton Peace Accords. And then there was the war again with Milosevic's Serbia over Kosovo to reverse the ethnic cleansing that was taking there. And after each of those, we pivoted to move from stopping the fighting to implementing the peace. The very first time, this was brand new to NATO. I mean, NATO was ready to fight World War III, and then at the end of it, it was kind of just over, you know, with massive destruction to the world, presumably. You know, there was no capacity, there was no doctrine, there was really no thinking about how do you implement this. And there was no relationship with the United Nations from the Cold War. So we had to reach out to the UN, to the OSCE. We had to reach out to countries like Canada, for example, that had a lot of experience in peacekeeping operations to help plan our operations. And we made mistakes. You know, when we deployed IFOR, the implementation force, into Bosnia, we set, in part because of the United States, very strict limits on what it could do. Only military tasks. It couldn't chase war criminals. It couldn't provide public security. And these led to problems, which had to be fixed over time and were. We learned with Kosovo, and I think this was a learning process of NATO. It was also a learning process of the administration. By the time of the Kosovo Air Campaign, Sandy Berger had brought me back to the White House, and I co-chaired an executive committee that did what we called planning for success during the 78-day air campaign. And we put together the plans for a NATO-led peacekeeping force. We put together the plans for a UN-led implementation force. And we learned a lot. You know, we made sure that there was clear integration between the civil and military side, down to just making sure they had the same sectors, for example. We understood and reflected in the planning that the military had to play the role of police for a period of time, as much as we didn't like it. But it had to play that role for a period of time until you could stand up local security forces. We understood the importance of standing up local security forces. When we first went into Bosnia, the measure of success on the civil side tended to be, did you have elections? Okay, we've had elections, thank goodness. We have a democracy. It wasn't quite that straightforward, but you know, the elections were the measure of merit. By the time we got to Kosovo, we realized that elections were just one step in all of this, but you really had to do a lot of institution building, and a key institution was the police and the judiciary system and ultimately the military.
Now, two thoughts come to mind, and I'm influenced here by a former guest we had on the program, Ambassador James Dobbins.
Yes,
And in researching
we worked
that,
very closely together on and, both
and,
of those.
In researching that interview, I recall that there was a real resistance in Washington to making permanent the institutions that would build on this learning curve that you just described. So I'm curious about that, because we are now obviously transitioning to doing the same thing in Afghanistan. And the lesson there was, we learned, we thought through what we had to do, we were working on the ground and implementing, but then we elected a new president whose team felt, well, we don't do nation building,
right?
Basically, then we went into Iraq, and we can say made some mistakes there, and now we're in Afghanistan. So what I'm curious about is our capacity to institutionalize the learning that you just described.
Well, you know, I said earlier that it was good every 4 to 8 years to have a new set of ideas and a new viewpoint and so forth. But there is a weakness in that, and I'm sure Ambassador Dobbins talked about that, and that is you lose some of the senior level knowledge that you need to have. So
political leadership, you mean political leadership?
Yeah, at the political level.
Yeah, right.
And when we transitioned to the Bush administration, there were a lot of lessons we learned from the Balkans. But the political appointees of the Bush administration, many of whom I worked with very closely, didn't want to hear about it. I mean, that was, as you said, nation building. The Balkans was the wrong way to go. Look at, our forces are committed there for some time to come. Look how we are in Afghanistan and Iraq. But there was a real reluctance to sort of to take on these lessons and a real desire to operate in a different fashion. And I think that was unfortunate. I think we missed some opportunities in thinking about how do we do the planning for Iraq, how do we manage Afghanistan, and only now are we learning these. The U.S. Army is becoming very good at counterinsurgency operations. I find this a little bit ironic because at the beginning of the Bush administration, I mentioned before, we had this small insurgency in northern Macedonia that we had to quell, which fortunately we were able to do successfully with our European partners and with the involvement of NATO. I was asked, the National Security Council, the principals, you know, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, wanted to look at various options, including military options. So being on the staff of the NSC, I was said, well, put together some guidance so DOD can develop some notional military options. And I thought, wow, you know, what are we facing here? It looks like an insurgency to me. Let's see what a little counterinsurgency option would look like. And I got back howls from the Pentagon. We don't do counterinsurgency. That was Vietnam. We don't do that anymore. Now they're very much involved in counterinsurgency and have obviously learned a lot. A question, and this is a question less for the political leadership and more for the institution, in this case of the Army and the military, is will we retain those lessons for the future? Since I would submit more wars that we face in the future are more likely to look like insurgencies than they are sort of, you know, the classic standoff with the Warsaw Pact, or will the institution say, well, you know, this was the passing fancy of you know, a one political leadership, and we can go back to our core missions after this. So I think we do need to do a better job of passing on lessons at a senior level, but also institutionally, adapting our institutions and adapting our learning and training to deal with the new challenges.
You said that you studied under here at Berkeley under Janos and Waltz, and from Janos, I suspect you learned about comparative studies,
yes,
and how situations differ.
Mm-hmm.
And from Waltz, you learned the big strategic picture. And so I guess the what I'm wondering about, and I know you're not an expert on Afghanistan, I'm not asking you to be, but to what extent down the road when these other conflicts occur, Afghanistan and who knows where else, to what extent do we have to have a mechanism to see the differences in the situation, the tribal structure in Afghanistan versus, you know, the ethnic conflict in the Balkans, the involvement of many regional actors in Afghanistan who can be spoilers, whereas in the case of the Balkans, it was really just the Russians. Mm-hmm. Talk a little about how we integrate those lessons from comparative studies and international relations, even though you said you were glad that some of your profs were professors and not government officials.
I think academia does have an important role to play. And I think about senior policymakers. The more senior you get in government, the less you know about the range of issues you're dealing with. And so policymakers, myself included, we're human beings, which means we can be lazy, particularly when we don't have a lot of time. We have to fall back on what we know. And one will take one assumption or one experience and apply it to another. So for somebody who did the Balkans, it was very easy for me to say, well, this sort of worked in the Balkans. Maybe this will work in Afghanistan. Somebody who didn't have the Balkans experience might reject it and say, well, let's try a different approach. And I think what's important is to support policymakers, and again, academia can help with this, the intel community can a little bit too, is to help policymakers understand where are their similarities and where are their differences. And so what tools and techniques might work in one case but might not work in another. So draw lessons but make sure they're applicable. So you need to help people at the policy level on that, but you also have to train people who are coming into various professions too. I think it's very important now that the Department of State, work increasingly to train new Foreign Service officers, not just to go to cocktail parties, that's not all that they do, but not just to conduct mm-hmm. traditional diplomacy, but to be ready to serve in something like a provincial reconstruction team, to think about how do you do institution building. It's terribly important that our Foreign Service, like our military, does things like lessons learned and figure out how do you put those into the teachings? How do you move that into doctrine? Doctrine is a word the military loves, the State Department hates, because doctrine, in their view, is too rigid for diplomacy. But doctrine is a way of encapsulating what you've learned from different conflicts and how might you apply that in the future?
You were in the National Security Council when the Bush administration came in and after the 9/11 attack. What was the learning process organizationally? The attack was unexpected, at least by the Bush administration, not necessarily by the Clinton administration, which claims that it had given warnings about the threat that al-Qaeda posed. So I'm just, as somebody who transitioned from one administration to the other in a government, what had to change with regard to the government being on top of this new issue in the face of the attack?
I was in the White House Situation Room on 9/11 with Dr. Rice, the National Security Advisor. She was having her morning senior director's meeting, and I was in there as the senior director doing the Balkans. So I probably gave her a report on what was going on in the Balkans, so forth and so on. And she had come into the room looking a little bit worried, and she told everyone, you know, the watchstanders who sit right outside of the Situation Room had just told her that a plane had flown into one of the World Trade Centers. And for some reason, you know, everyone at that point thought it was a small plane. I think people couldn't imagine it was a large one. And she'd just been on the phone with the president, who was in Florida, telling him about this. And then partway through of our meeting, we could see she was a little distracted. One of the watchstanders came in and passed her a note, and she read the note, and she said, "A plane has now struck the other tower. I think we ought to call this meeting to a close." So we all got up. The folks who did counterterrorism, you know, and dealt with issues like that stayed behind in the Situation Room. The rest of us who did the Balkans, you know, went back to our office. And soon enough, we were evacuated from the whole White House complex because there was concern, well-founded, that a plane was headed our way as well. But that moment of shock, you know, clearly caught the attention of the president and the whole national security apparatus. We shifted from, you know, one set of national security priorities to another, which was the global war on terrorism. In a real sense that the country was at risk of further attacks. The only way to prevent them wasn't just to play defense, but to play offense as well. And I remember Condi Rice, who's a strategic thinker, sort of asking us, I was sort of embarrassed she asked us. I should have thought of this all by myself. She sort of asked all the senior directors, like about 10 days after the attack, what does this mean for your area? What are the new challenges? And are there terrible thing to ask in a way, but are there any opportunities from this? And so I thought about, okay, how do we use this in the Balkans? Others thought about, how do we use this with the Chinese? How do we use this with the Russians? And it did open new forms of cooperation that we hadn't had in the past. But the administration became consumed, rightly so, with the risk of further attacks. I mean, remember back there, we were worried there was going to be follow-on attacks that were going to be worse. I spent a lot of time in secure, undisclosed locations, you know, getting ready for those follow-on attacks. And when you're in these secure, undisclosed locations, thinking about, okay, what do we do if a nuclear weapon goes off in New York? It kind of changes your priorities a little bit, thinking about how do you make sure that doesn't happen. So it really gave the administration a focus on preventing terrorism and preventing nuclear terrorism, one that actually continued through to this administration, where you have, you know, President Obama saying those are at the height of our agenda. It also caused us to change our operations. I came back as the executive secretary of the National Security Council, which is sort of the number three position, and I was in charge of, you know, emergency arrangements in case there were another 9/11. I was in charge of making sure that we were ready when the Iraq War started. And our focus before the National Security Council just looked overseas. In the meantime, the Homeland Security Council was set up looking at home. And we realized, you know, there wasn't a distinct boundary there. You had the two staffs had to work together. And so I worked very hard under the direction of Condi and Steve Hadley and with Fran Townsend, who was in charge of Homeland Security, to integrate those operations, to take, for example, our White House Situation Room and make sure that it was capable of looking not just overseas for threats, but at home, bringing in FBI, bringing in people from the Department of Homeland Security. The administration set up the Department of Homeland Security. So there was a real effort to change our focus and also change the structures that supported it.
You said something that struck me as interesting, namely she asked what were the opportunities in different regions. And what followed was the Iraq War, which has been rightly, the argument has been made that it was the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time. I'm not asking you to comment on that, but what I'm curious about is if we wanted to avoid a dysfunction in the future in the flow of information about a particular problem and how we should respond to it, what are the safeguards that we can put in place to achieve that? So I'm asking about the future. I'm not asking you right to comment on the failures of the Bush administration. And is it really the case that in the end the president has so much power and he's been elected through our democratic process that he will do what he wants to do?
Well, I think one of the safeguards is a good intelligence community that is ready to push back on policymakers occasionally. Their job isn't to make policy, but their job is to make sure that policymakers, you know, operate on the right assumptions, with the right information, with the best assessments and alternative assessments that are available. While I was at National Defense University, I was asked to participate in one of the lessons learned series by the Director of National Intelligence. And I thought about, okay, what have I learned as a policymaker learning with the intel community? And I met with all these young analysts. And I said, one of the things you guys have to do is you need to challenge us policymakers. The point I made earlier, you know, we're human beings. We'll take one experience and we'll apply it elsewhere. If you think we're making wrong assumptions, you have to tell us. And I remember one junior analyst in the back of this cavernous room saying, Ambassador, that was probably the first policymaker he'd ever seen. Ambassador, how do we challenge a policymaker? And I said, well, you do that because you need to develop a relationship of trust. You need to be part of the policy process without becoming politicized. And I think one of the things that happened, unfortunately, in the lead-up to the Iraq War is we had a national intelligence estimate that was just wrong. I remember reading, I wasn't directly involved in the decision-making on the Iraq War. I was involved in some of the implementation, all the presidential phone calls and preparing in case of emergencies at home and so forth. But I remember reading the national intelligence estimate that came out, and I thought, okay, they're getting ready to reconstitute their nuclear capability. They're active, you know, in other areas. This is the right thing to do. A lot of people read that national intelligence estimate and came to a similar conclusion, and the estimate was wrong. Now, I think the intel community has learned a lot from it, but it does show the importance of, you know, making sure that policymakers are operating with good data and not just making assumptions. My guess is there were some policymakers who wanted to assume that Saddam Hussein was somehow behind it in some fashion. That was a wrong assumption, and it was a wrong assumption that Iraq was reconstituting its nuclear capabilities.
Mm-hmm. So it would seem that in a situation like this, at a certain point, what's happening within the government doesn't air the debate enough, and so do we need to turn to the press and to the public discourse to shape things up? Because if in the intelligence community they weren't questioning the assumptions of the political leaders and vice versa, then it really took the critics outside to be listened to. Is that fair?
Well, but, you know, the lead up to the war, there were a lot of sort of, you know, quiet and secret decisions. But on the other hand, you know, the big choice about going to war or not, that was out there. It was being publicly debated. It was being debated on the Hill. I would argue perhaps, you know, our Congress has a greater role in asking some of those questions, in posing some of those issues to make sure that we're making the right decisions. I mean, in the end, you know, the president, who is elected by the people, you know, does have to make those tough calls. I mean, you can't have, you know, in dealing with, you know, sort of, national security threats, you can't sort of allow the system to succumb to paralysis because there's so many different views and nobody makes the final decision. You need to have somebody who makes the final decision. But you do need to make sure that you have the requisite debate. Part of the role of the National Security Council is, and it doesn't always play that role, is to make sure that disparate views come forward to the president. And that all those views are debated and all the options are considered.
The other threat that became more apparent after 9/11 was the whole problem of proliferation.
Mm-hmm.
You said you were a student of Ken Waltz who didn't worry about proliferation. Well, your job became to worry about it, and you represented, you were ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency. This is a big problem area, and, you know, our time is limited, but what I would like to do is expose some dimensions of the problem. So what we have in place, so let me do a little brief summary and then you take it from there. We have in place an international structure, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is proving in places inadequate to address some of the new problems. Some of the new problems include non-governmental organizations that are aspiring to get weapons, taking the form of things like the AQCON network, which was selling materials to, in one case, rogue states, or more than one case, rogue states, but also potentially to non-state actors. Talk a little about the role you undertook, because I think one of the main problems there is the state of Iran and its rush to become to move from being a wannabe to being a nuclear weapons power. How do we respond to a situation like that? How can international institutions make it work? And what role does the U.S. play in moving the agenda in that direction?
Mm-hmm. Well, Harry, you're absolutely right. The nuclear nonproliferation treaty and regime were written in an era where only nation states could develop the technology to build nuclear weapons. And we're now in an era where you can get this information, as we've seen through the AQCON regime, black market network, from non-governmental organizations. We're now in an era where we saw recently, when the Israelis bombed a secret reactor being built in Syria, where North Korea, a rogue state, is ready to sell technology, nuclear weapons technology. And we're now in an era where there are countries, a limited number of countries, but countries like Iran, who are willing to exploit the Non-Proliferation Treaty, saying that they're developing nuclear technology for peaceful means when it's pretty apparent that they aren't. Now, there are a whole set of challenges inherent in that, which I had to grapple with when I was in Vienna. The first challenge stemmed from that NIE that was wrong on Iraq. I would show up in Vienna in the beginning and I'd say, we need to worry about Iran, you know, developing a nuclear weapons capability. And a lot of people would sort of reply, sometimes politely, sometimes not, Ambassador, why should we listen to you after the United States got it so wrong on Iraq? And I would have to spend a certain amount of time just with the educational process of saying, well, don't listen to me. You know, look at these reports from the IAEA. Look at the nature of their program. Look at the ties to AQCON. Look at the fact there's no civilian purpose. And it took a while, but I think eventually we got to the point, particularly with Ahmadinejad and his loud statements, and with their violations of multiple Security Council resolutions, we got to the point where most countries in the world accepted there is something fundamentally wrong with this program. The next challenge, though, was to get countries to stand up and say that and join a global consensus to say that. The Iranians wanted this to be a fight between them and the United States. There were many times when in meetings of the IAEA board, the Iranian representative would stand up, clearly hoping to pick a fight with me. And my main role was to sort of, you know, zip my lips shut and let him make an idiot out of himself. But they wanted this to be a dispute between the United States, the great Satan, and innocent Iran, whereas my goal was to make it what it was, a dispute between Iran's leaders and the rest of the world. But you had to line up the rest of the world, and the Iranians were very good, we're seeing it today, at going to individual countries and trying to break apart this international coalition of concern. So the next first challenge was convincing countries there's a problem. Next challenge is getting countries to come together to say publicly there's a challenge to support Security Council resolutions. The third challenge is the one that we haven't overcome, and I don't know how we're going to, and that is an Iranian leadership that's clearly determined to have at a minimum the capability to have nuclear weapons and perhaps the weapons themselves. And as you suggest, you know, there are a variety of reasons they could be pursuing this. I don't pretend to be in their minds. I don't pretend to be an expert on Iranian leadership. But like any aspiring nuclear weapons state, perhaps they see the possibility of prestige or influence or security. And apparently their desire for those hasn't outweighed the amount of either inducements or penalties that we've been able to put on the table. So I think we confront a real problem right now. I think Iran's going to have a nuclear weapons capability or nuclear weapons in the coming 5 to 10 years. And I think the challenge for the United States and other like-minded countries is to contain the effects of that, not just in the region, but also to sustain the overall nonproliferation regime so you don't have more countries, particularly in the Middle East, decide that they can also develop nuclear weapons.
Is the danger that the regime gets the weapons, or is the greater danger that they might give them to a terrorist organization, since there is such a fuzzy line between the Iranian state and the regime and terrorist groups? The reason I ask this is I think Waltz, Sig Hecker, I think would say they are less worried about a state acquiring nuclear weapons. Now, putting aside the problem that if one goes, a whole bunch will go, that's mm-hmm. a different problem. But that if a state, even Iran, were to get nuclear weapons, and we should mention that this goal of nuclear weapons goes back to the Shah, I think. And so the question is, if a state gets the weapon, they can be deterred. But if a terrorist organization gets the weapons or the state gives weapons or material to a terrorist organization, it's not clear that they can be deterred.
I see two sets of security risks, sort of first-order security risks and second-order. The first order are if Iran acquires a nuclear weapon or even just the capability to have one quickly and they let everyone in the region know. I'm not worried that Iran's leaders are going to use a nuclear weapon. They're probably not going to detonate one on NATO or on Israel or something like that. But I am worried that they're going to be much more emboldened to act aggressively in their foreign policy and that they may be willing to use asymmetric means or naval forces or ballistic missiles to try to intimidate, to try to posture, to try to bluster, to try to even assault their neighbors, with the goal of expanding their influence in the region, expelling Western influence from the region.
They're already doing that, aren't they? Aren't they already
doing
that?
Well, they are. But my concern is they would act even more aggressively if they felt they could do that, and that the countries around them would start worrying about our security commitments to them and perhaps would start accommodating what the Iranians are doing. And there is a concern about, you know, a group like Hezbollah getting nuclear weapons. Now, I think for the most part, if a leadership acquires nuclear weapons, those are the most destructive devices around, and those are precious national assets. It's hard for me to imagine, you know, giving nuclear weapons to a terrorist group unless they're under strict directions to use it right away to try to hide, you know, who is the source of the use of nuclear weapons. But on the other hand, I am worried about a group like Hezbollah acting much more aggressively. Imagine Hezbollah with a nuclear weapon. Now, combine that with Israel that has lost its nuclear weapons monopoly. You know, you can draw out lots of little scenarios that don't end very well. Now, the second set of security risks, the second order security risks, are that other countries in the region will decide to acquire nuclear weapons. And I see three candidates. I see Saudi Arabia, I see Egypt, and I see NATO ally Turkey. And you know, a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, I think everyone can agree that's a bad thing. Maybe Kenneth Waltz would still support it, but I think most people would agree that that's a bad thing. It's the wrong place to have a nuclear arms race. But let's remember, a nuclear arms race may not be fast. I mean, none of the three countries that I mentioned, to our knowledge, have the type of bomb-making capability that Iran is developing. But we are subject to surprise. Remember how suddenly in the 80s, Saudi Arabia had CSS-2 missiles. You know, from China that surprised us. Some think they may have a similar arrangement with Pakistan to get weapons for those missiles, to get nuclear weapons. So whether it's fast and full of surprises or slow and fitful, I think a nuclear arms race increases the risk of miscalculation, of accident, and maybe even the use of nuclear weapons. So I think these are all reasons first, you know, to continue with our diplomacy to try to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons, recognizing that we may not be successful, and therefore work on the regional security framework and work on convincing other countries not to follow Iran's suit.
I'm curious about your thinking about the Revolutionary Guard in Iran, because there's a lot of evidence that in the last few years in Iran, the domestic situation has changed, and in addition to the Ayatollah, the Revolutionary Guard has assumed a newfound power, both in the businesses of Iran and in this whole process of acquiring. Do you see Iran as a particular threat because you're dealing with an organization which is not the traditional military in Iran, but essentially an organization that has a background in external terrorism? What I'm just saying is that something people in the government worry about?
I talked to an Iranian expatriate a couple of years ago as part of my quest to try to understand the Iranian leadership and their motivations. And he said, think about the Iranian regime as a bunch of concentric circles. And there's one circle in which there are about 100 people who may be ministers, may not be ministers, you know, who are involved in making the decisions. And he said a few years ago, most of the people in that ring were clerics. Now most of the people in that circle are from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And I think that gives us a challenge in that, first off, they are revolutionary. I mean, they're committed to the revolutionary fervor. These are individuals who grew up in the generation where the U.S. was the great Satan. And these are individuals who are worried about maintaining control. And they're worried about, you know, how they benefit from the current regime. And, oh, by the way, sometimes sanctions could benefit them as well, too, because they're going to run the operations that provide the best way of busting those sanctions. So I think I am worried about the IRGC being the leadership. We also need to think about how do we best influence them. Because remember, for diplomacy to be successful, whether it's the diplomacy of stopping them from getting nuclear weapons or the diplomacy of containing them afterwards, we have to influence the decision-making of the leaders. Now, the Supreme Leader is the ultimate decision maker, but I'm told he doesn't like to make decisions. He likes to rely on consensus. So how do you figure out who are the key decision makers around him? How do you influence them? It's a little bit like what you did during the Kosovo air campaign, working on the cronies around Milosevic. How do you convince them they don't have an interest in having nuclear weapons, or they have an interest in eventually giving them up? I think that's one of the challenges for U.S. policymakers. And what makes it hard is we don't have perfect insight into that decision-making process.
What about the problem of in the eyes of others, the ambiguity of the U.S. role? And what I have in mind here is special cases and America's dealings with those special cases. India comes to mind. Israel comes to mind. In both cases, in the case of India, we just concluded an agreement to try to bring them into the non-proliferation regime by essentially putting aside their nuclear bomb-making capability, but trying to put controls and help them develop their civilian reactors. Well, India's neighbor is Pakistan. You know, they are going to react to that and see that as a threat to their national security. In the case of Israel, Israel has, you know, let's say 50 to 100 nuclear weapons, just a wild guess, that the case is made, well, in the Middle East, you know, Israel and Iran are in competition for regional hegemony. Why do we assume, you know, that Israel's case is special and they shouldn't be included in any kind of non-proliferation rules that we apply? I'm not suggesting that Israel is selling nuclear weapons to anybody, just that the other actors in the region can't as easily recognize the special cases that we define.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I see Israel's reported possession of nuclear weapons as being largely defensive in nature. I mean, this is their defense of last resort should the state come under threat. I'm worried that Iran doesn't see nuclear weapons as purely defensive in nature. I'm worried that Iran's leaders see nuclear weapons as something that gives them not only prestige but also influence and supports their regional interests. And so I look at the two very differently. But that said, when I was the ambassador in Vienna and I would travel around a lot to the Arab world and elsewhere and talk about Iran's nuclear program, the first question I would get asked in the Middle East was ambassador, how come you talk about Iran, not about Israel? And my answer to that, which I happen to believe, was, you know, well, we, whether it's the last administration or this administration, would like to see, you know, a Middle East free of nuclear weapons. But the first challenge you got to deal with is the fact that you have Iran, you know, pursuing the capability to have nuclear weapons, and you have an overall verification regime that's not functioning effectively, as we see in the case of the Syrian reactor, where Syria, you know, having built this reactor with the support of North Korea, is now able to stymie any IAEA investigation into it. So my response to the question, Ambassador, what about Israel, is say, well, you know, someday we'd like everyone to give up nuclear weapons, but here's the problem we have to deal with today. Now, India, I was in the White House at the time, not working on India, but I sort of observed the deliberations on India early in the administration. That was one of the early priorities of the Bush administration. Let's change our relationship with India. And I remember we asked the Indians, what's important to you? And they came back with a list of three things that was important to them, and one was cooperation on civil nuclear energy. And I remember in the U.S. government, there was sort of a, how can we do that? And the nonproliferation people said, no, we can't do that. I mean, it'll send the wrong message to the rest of the world. It'll undercut our policy on nonproliferation. But then there were a lot of people who were saying, but, you know, we have a stake in changing our relationship with India. And it wasn't just about China. I mean, it was about, you know, a great democracy with common values and common interests and so forth. And so the administration went through this very difficult discussion internally about what makes sense. In the end, the conclusion was, well, if we can convince ourselves that we are strengthening the nonproliferation regime, then we should go ahead and do it. And there was a recognition we don't have to just convince ourselves. We have to convince Congress, and we have to convince the 45 other countries in the nuclear suppliers group that set restrictions on nuclear trade.
And you did, I guess.
We did. It wasn't easy. We had the same debate each case. And I remember, you know, in Vienna, we had this debate in the nuclear suppliers group, and there were very strong views. You know, a lot of Europeans were worried that we were completely destroying the nonproliferation regime. And there, I actually had a great ally, and that was Mohammed El-Baradei. I mean, Mohammed El-Baradei said, no, you got to think about this differently. This is a way to bring India as close as we can to the nonproliferation regime and actually put some constraints on them, recognizing you're not going to be able to convince them to give up their nuclear weapons as long as Pakistan and, more importantly, China has nuclear weapons. So I think in the end, this was a movement that strengthened the overall nonproliferation regime, and I think the President Obama agrees with that. But it complicated my diplomacy because, you know, people would say, well, Ambassador, what about Israel? What about India? And I would have to spend a lot of time focusing back on the immediate problem, which was Iran.
One final question requiring a brief answer. A lot of what we've just discussed is sort of adapting to new situations, mm-hmm. transforming in institutions if one is going to make policy. What could people learn from your career? What could students learn from your career about what makes you able to do that as a government official? Is it your education? Is it your thinking through problems as they emerge, or what?
I think it's two things, one of which I mentioned. One was the need to think strategically, but then figure out how do you implement that operationally and tactically. You know, what's the big picture? What are we trying to achieve? And then how do you translate that into concrete actions? And normally those aren't unilateral actions. Usually those are working with other like-minded countries. The second thing that I think is important is a readiness and an openness to listen to outside advice. And again, this goes back to academia. This goes back to all the think tanks that are in Washington. This goes back to the intelligence community. You know, a real desire from the outset to hear differing views and figure out how do you incorporate those views. I think that openness is important. It's important not just so you can report those views to the people you're working for, but it's also important to challenge your own preconceptions and see if you can, you know, people love having their ideas stolen. You know, particularly if the government is sort of saying, that's a good idea.
But, yeah.
No, academics too. I mean, stolen and not in a legal sense, but in the sense of, that's a good idea. We're going to figure out how to implement that. You know, and take advantage of that. I mean, take advantage of the fact that there are people who are ready to give their expert advice and figure out how to sort out, you know, the kooks from the ones who can really help you.
Ambassador, I want to thank you very much for coming back to Berkeley and being on our program. Very informative discussion.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.